Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello again. This is Steve Behrman, and welcome to Wiki Politiki. This is our pre-Christmas show, and we're calling it Christmas in the Trenches to commemorate a remarkable event, the Christmas Truce during World War I in 1914, when soldiers on all sides broke the trance of separation and celebrated Christmas together. Please enjoy the song written by John McCutcheon and performed by Shanti Norman, Christmas in the Trenches.
My name is Francis Tolliver. I come from Liverpool. 2 years ago, the war was waiting for me after school. To Belgium and to Flanders, to Germany to here, I fought for king and country I love dear. 'Twas Christmas in the trenches, where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were still, no Christmas songs were sung. Our families back in England were toasting us that day. They're brave and glorious lads so far away. I was lying with my messmate on a cold and rocky ground. Across the lines of battle came a most peculiar sound. Says I, now listen up, me boys. Each soldier strained to hear, as one young German voice sang out so clear. He's singing bloody well, you know, my partner says to me. Soon one by one, each German voice joined in harmony. The cannons rested silent, the gas cloud rolled no more, as Christmas brought us respite from the war. As soon as they were finished and the reverent pause was spent, God rest ye merry gentlemen, struck up some lads from Kent. The next they sang was Stille Nacht, 'tis silent night, says I. And in two tongues one song filled up that sky. There's someone coming towards The frontline sentry cried. All eyes were fixed on one young soldier coming from their side. His troops' flag, like a Christmas star, shone on that plain so bright. As he bravely strode unarmed into the night. Then one by one on either side walked into no man's land. With neither gun nor bayonet, we met there hand in hand. We shared some secret brandy and wished each other well. And in a flare-lit soccer game, we gave them hell. We traded chocolate cigarettes and photographs from home. These sons and fathers far away from families of their own. Tom Sanders played his squeeze box, and they had a violin. This curious and unlikely band of men. Was France once more. With sad farewells, we each began to settle back to war. But the question haunted every heart that lived that wondrous night. Whose family have I fixed within my sight? 'Twas Christmas in the trenches where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were warmed as songs of peace were sung. For the walls they kept between us to exact the work of war had been crumbled and were gone. My name is Francis Tolliver. In Liverpool I dwell. Each Christmas comes since World War I, I've learned its lessons well. That the ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame. And on each end of the rifle we
Christmas in the Trenches, sung by Shanti Norman from her 2000 CD, Shanti. You know, this song has become as much a Christmas tradition as It's a Wonderful Life, because it points us in the direction of waking up from that trance that we've been in for thousands and thousands of years. Me versus you, one against the other, dominate or be dominated. So how do we break the trance of warfare once and for all? Our first guest today, David Swanson, has devoted his life recent times to that very issue. He's an author, an activist, a journalist, a radio host. He's director of worldbeyondwar.org and campaign coordinator for rootsaction.org. His books include War is a Lie and When the World Outlawed War. He blogs at davidswanson.org and waristacrime.org, and he hosts Talk Nation Radio. He's also been a Nobel Prize nominee the past 3 years. David Swanson, welcome.
Hey, Steve, great to be here.
Good, and you know, I understand you're doing your Christmas show on Christmas in the Trenches as well. What's your take on this legendary and yet true occurrence?
I think it's, you know, it's easy to romanticize and exaggerate it, but it's also, it's very hard to overestimate the importance of the fact that war can be stopped by human agency. People engaged in the middle of fighting a war can simply cease to engage in it, and that's something that can be done anywhere, anytime. And so there's a proposal now from the United Nations that has support around the world for an Olympic truce. That is, you know, a truce for those weeks in this upcoming February when the Winter Olympics will be in South Korea. That even has South Korea asking the United States to cease and desist from its war rehearsal flights during that truce, not just war, but war games, war exercises, and this would be for that period of the Olympics plus 1 week on either side. But there's a peace group that I like and support that proposes a year without war in the year 2020. But when and if these things can be done, the argument immediately arises, why resume? Why start the war back up? Why go back to shooting the Germans or the Brits, the day after Christmas? And in some of these truces, they didn't. In some, they lasted a couple of days. But why not make it forever? And of course, there have been many, many truces in many, many wars, including some that are happening right now that have been resumed. And this one we know about because it was so fantastic an event, but also because it was on Christmas and it makes a better story. There are lots of truces that have happened on other days of the calendar year, and we have to recognize that, you know, we have this choice. We can cease engaging in collective madness and not resume it again.
You know, there's a famous quote from Dwight Eisenhower that the people of the world want peace so badly that one day their governments will have to give it to them. This may seem obvious to a lot of people, but what is in the way of this permanent truce, this awakening to the insanity of what we've been doing for so many centuries?
Well, people like Dwight Eisenhower, for one thing. It's good for politicians to make good statements. They need to match them with good actions. And even the good statements, such as the warning about the military-industrial complex, which came from President Eisenhower on his last day in office, is surrounded by and put in context of, you know, blaming the Soviet commies for everything. We have no choice. We must do it. But for President Obama to go to Hiroshima and not even apologize and say, well, war is tragic, but we have no choice, and to accept a Nobel Peace Prize, and, you know, for the first and only time in 117 years of the Nobel Peace Prize, to make the case for war because, sadly, we just have no choice, is shameful. It's ridiculous on an intellectual level. It's shameful on a moral level. And what we're up against is this bad education, this misunderstanding, the proliferation of these myths that war is necessary or even good and glorious, that it defends us rather than, as is empirically demonstrable, endangers us, on top of which it's the top destroyer of the environment, top waste of financial resources, top cause of eliminating our civil liberties, top cause of militarizing our local police, and on and on and on. We're also up against the profit interests, the benefits to a select few of the war industries, which are, you know, the myths, again, will tell us that there's at least an economic upside to war. War, you know, shameful and disgusting as it may be, you have U.S. officials arguing that war is a jobs creator, and that justifies, you know, slaughtering millions of people around the globe. Actually, that's not true. You know, it actually is an economic drain. So even on its own ground. It's a bad argument. So we have to take on incredible levels of corruption. It's an uphill struggle that has to be waged arm in arm with forces of reforming our corrupt systems of government. But we fundamentally have to build popular support and popular passion for taking nonviolent action towards ending the institution of war. And that starts with recognizing that it is an institution and that it can be ended.
You know, we met, I think it was early in 2005. I think it was at the first Progressive Democrats conference in Washington, D.C. And you've been an activist for a while. What was it that geared you toward this particular pathway, world beyond war and so on? What moved you toward that particular mission?
Well, not progressivism and not Democrats and not America, to take those initials of PDA. You know, wonderfully well-intended creation of my good friend, the late Tim Carpenter. But, I've struggled with this because I've never gone anywhere in the past decades and not been asked this question, and I've generally brushed it off or given a short answer, you know, and I actually just wrote a lengthy chapter for a book for someone answering this question, and it took me a couple of drafts, and I still don't know if they like what I wrote, but I think if I was able to, after going through chronologically, you know, recording my childhood and early adulthood and so forth, and you know, because people just insist on that stuff that it doesn't interest me at all, and to figure out why I'm a peace activist, I really didn't come up with any answer other than I don't believe lies. I don't, you know, to the extent that I'm aware of, which then, you know, becomes a tautology. Anybody could say that. But I really recognize a lot more things as lies and propaganda than do some other people that I know and respect. And because of that, you know, and because I was raised like most children on earth to being told that violence is bad, don't hit your little friends, you know, solve your problems with words, and because I had absolutely zero respect for authority or adulthood, and I applied that same standard to governments, you know, and I recognized, and I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, you know, where above all the chief industry, the chief project is mass murder abroad, industrialized scale. You know, I had to recognize that either that was wrong for governments too, or it wasn't wrong for anybody, or I just had to live with the inconsistency, you know. I mean, this is why as a kid growing up, the minute I heard of atheism, I said, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense, you know, because I've been trying to make heads or tails out of religion, and I never could, you know. So when it comes to war, if you try to make sense of it, if you try to make sense of the idea that mass murder is not desirable and, you know, simultaneously keep in your head the idea that members of the U.S. military are providing a service and should be thanked for that service, well, I mean, either your head explodes or you know, figure out how to reconcile these contradictions. And because, you know, and once you open yourself up to recognizing that somebody might be lying to you, even about important matters that will kill millions of people, that when the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations yesterday stood in front of a missile and said, this is an Iranian missile that threatens peace on Earth, and we must do lots of horrible unspecified things to Iran for the side of goodness and truth, if you open yourself up to the possibility that that's, you know, pure, unadulterated BS, and look into it and examine the facts, you know, you're gonna be a peace activist. Because war is the worst thing that human beings do to each other and the rest of the planet, including the climate of the planet. You know, and you're gonna try to make the world a better place. You're gonna try to conduct your life so that you can sleep well at night. Well, then you're going to be a peace activist, and you're going to, like me, become sort of dismissive of that question and turn it around and say, well, why in the world are you not a peace activist? You know, stop asking me why I am. So
Okay, good. Well, we're going to take a break right now. We'll be back with David Swanson and uncover this issue a little bit more.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Imagine, it is the year 2039. A single corporation controls most of the world through genetic modification, food, and drugs. A senior geneticist's lover dies, launching him on a quest to take down the psychopathic CEO and the handful of elite families that control the corporation. The feature film Corporate Prey, based on the novel of the same name, points us toward a dystopian future where we seem to be headed. Huge corporations do largely control our farms and our pharma. And wealthy elites seem to be operating to the detriment of most humans. Can we reverse course? Can prophecy lead to prevention? Can a movie awaken enough of us in time? To find out more and how you can help bring this enlightening film to light, go to CorporatePrey.com. Corporate Prey. That's P-R-E-Y.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket. A tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Steve Behrman back, WikiPolitiki. We're talking about Christmas in the Trenches, and my guest is David Swanson. He's the director of World Beyond War, author of War is a Lie. Speaking of uncomfortable situations, David, you were here in the Bay Area where I live. I think it was May of 2016. You and Norman Solomon did a presentation at a local bookstore. And one of the things that you propose is that we don't vote for any candidates who support war. And at that point, it was, I don't think Hillary was the nominee at that time. But I could see that there was some discomfort in the audience, given our propensity to choose the lesser evils. What do we do now? I want to talk a little bit about that, because at that point, it was clear that you were not supporting Hillary no matter what happened. And so I'm just curious as to what kind of pushback or feedback you got on that.
Well, the usual. But I think that the most difficult point for me to communicate, either because I'm wrong or because I'm not good at communicating it or because it's so foreign to most people's thinking, is that elections are of much less importance than people imagine. I would argue almost negligible importance. And yet we devote a great deal of our energies to debating them and arguing over strategies related to them. And so I'm almost inclined to just simply agree with whatever anybody's position is on elections, lesser evil, anti-lesser evil, et cetera, my own position being the latter. But because I want to move on, to working on education, working on mass movements, working on nonviolent disruption and creative activism and global and local activism that have little to do with elections. I don't want to give the false impression that I think we shouldn't have elections, or I don't think it's critical that we have them. I think, to the extent that we do have them, which is much more of a reality at the local level and in certain countries than it is at the national level in the United States, we need to make use of them, and we need to work very hard for the reforms that would allow us to have open, legitimate, representative elections and even actual democracy, at the levels where we're lacking those, including obviously the federal level in the United States. But because nobody could care less about anything I just said, and everybody wants to know, but who will you vote for? No matter, I could scream 100 times, it doesn't matter, and that's all, they'll still just want to know that. I think that we're better off in the long run taking a principled position that we will not vote for indecent candidates, corrupt, mass-murdering candidates, that there has to be some threshold, right? I mean, imagine that the candidates were, and this is entirely conceivable if the Earth lasts that long under those circumstances, come 3 years from now, the candidates are Donald Trump versus somebody even worse than Donald Trump. Because then the lesser evil argument is, well, we must vote for Donald Trump. And I maintain that no, there has to be some limit that you can't cross, that Donald Trump is too hideously awful for us to support, even if the other one is worse. Now, for me, that was true of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. That both of them were beyond the pale. For other people, it wasn't. For lack of good information or different perspective on what that information should be valued as, I think at some point you have to say this is unacceptable, not for the purity of your soul and not getting your hands dirty and, to hell with strategically saving the world, but because this is what I think will strategically save the world, if anything will, is telling these candidates they cannot have our votes at all if they don't have better positions on X, Y, and Z. Because otherwise, we aren't going to accomplish, getting those policies enacted. If it becomes impossible for either a Republican or a Democrat to get our votes unless they take a decent position on, things like war, then we're going to have more power to persuade one or the other of them to take a decent position, And so would I have voted for the Democrat over the Republican in Alabama for the Senate? Probably, yes. I actually have never voted for any Republican in my life, but I think we have to be aware that this is a Democrat who's entering the United States Senate, where the majority of the money he will vote on what to do with will be for one and only one enterprise, namely war. And his entire website and platform and campaign has not, to my knowledge, acknowledged the existence of the outside world, of anything beyond the U.S. borders, of 96% of humanity. It just doesn't exist. And this is true of each and every Democrat who has run for Congress in each and every special election, and aren't they special, that has dominated the news to the detriment of any coverage of actual governance and human life for the past 12 months. Whereas every single Republican candidate for Congress and the Senate has bashed immigrants and demanded walls and wars and bombs and so forth, so to take a party that maintains silence on the majority of what it's running for and isn't even obliged to tell anybody what it thinks of anything, and say, well, that's preferable to, you know, this hideous party of, you know, racist warmongers. Well, in most cases so far this year, and more so in the early months of this year, it wasn't good enough. The Democrats lost on that. And the lesson the Democratic Party is going to take from defeating this, you know, pedophile in Alabama is going to be, let's get more pedophiles to run against. You know, let's be the party that's not this horrible Republican. And if the horrible Republican looks pretty good, let's be the party that's not Trump and tie him or her to Trump. And let that, thereby we can avoid having any positions on anything, because nobody will care what we are running as. We just won't be those other guys. I think you have to force anybody who wants your vote to be someone who deserves it. Otherwise, you're going to get people who don't deserve it, and you're going to get the disastrous policies that we're getting right now.
Yep, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, we have one, the brand that the Democrats have been, vote for us, we're not as bad as the other guys, is a failed brand, and that's why we have Donald Trump as president right now. What I'd like to get into is, what do you see on the horizon that's happening right now or in the near future that is the most cause for, where's the light? Where are we moving in a positive direction? What encourages you right now?
Well, I don't feel encouraged or discouraged or have much sympathy for the demand that we feel one or the other. I think it's a little self-indulgent. I think we have a moral obligation to do everything we can to save this planet, whether it looks like we're going to succeed or it looks like we're going to fail. The question doesn't really interest me. But where I think we have chances of getting a foothold and making some progress, and where we absolutely have to try, include the areas of Yemen, where there is growing demand that the United States and its European and Gulf allies stop inflicting mass starvation and disease and death on the people of Yemen. This has a chance of actually getting somewhere in that, you know, most difficult of places, the U.S. Congress, in part because that new senator and the replacement for Al Franken are a couple of ciphers. Nobody has a clue what either of them will do on anything. It includes North Korea, where, as I mentioned, there's a demand for an Olympics truce. There's a demand for an immediate truce. There's pushback from South Korea on the United States. There's, you know, at least the statement from the secretary of ExxonMobil that he wants to sit down with the North Koreans. And of course, there's always been, you'd never know it from the U.S. media, the willingness of the North Koreans to sit down and talk if the United States ceases its war games, which are the furthest thing from games, and which it would cease if it complied with the Olympic truce or any earlier truce. And I think Iran is an area where there is a lot of passion and potential for action. You know, when people come to understand that there is another push for a war on Iran, and that we've stopped it repeatedly, that we stopped it in 2007 and we stopped it in 2015, and we can stop it again, and we have to stop it again, and we have to make clear to Donald Trump that it won't save his popularity, that in fact he will be even less popular. We have to get some polls taken now where the question is asked beforehand, which gives us the advantage. You know, will your approval of Donald Trump go up if he attacks Iran? Because even the people who would say yes after he attacked Iran will say no now before he actually does it. You know, we have to push back on that. There's a lot going on at worldbeyondwar.org, where I work. There's an events page that's full of events. We've got a big conference coming up in January with a big new coalition opposing foreign U.S. military bases. There's divestment campaigns, rule of law campaigns, local resolution campaigns. I mean, there's every possible angle that one might want to help out with or engage in if you check out worldbeyondwar.org.
Well, thank you. Thank you, David. You know, that's really the question. I'm sure that people who are listening are going, what can I do? How can I participate? What can I do that's going to have some possible impact? And I really appreciate what you said earlier about you do what's right because you do what's right. And unfortunately, that's kind of an old-fashioned idea that's fallen by the wayside. We need to revive that. What can the ordinary person do to feed this idea that war is insane, it's obsolete, and as Swami would say, obsolethal?
Obsolethal is a good term, I think. That's what we're looking at. Well, if you go to worldbeyondwar.org and you click on events and you click on event resources, there we've got wonderful videos that can be used, that you can view on your own, you know, in our little hibernated, segregated world of individuals, or you can use for events. There's a list of speakers you can invite for events. We will make sure to get great speakers to you. There's a list of activities and actions and campaigns and event activities that can be done around them. And if you click on the section of our website with chapters, you can find your nearest chapter or how to form one, and we will help you by contacting everybody in your area and asking them to get in touch with you and form a new chapter and start holding events. There are things that can be done locally. You can get your local governments to pass useful resolutions and ordinances and programs to work on studying conversion from your local war industries to peace industries. If you claim to live in an area without any local war industries, I would be happy to enlighten you otherwise, or to celebrate that incredible rarity if it actually is true and see what we can make of it. But there are endless possibilities for things that you can do at the local level, and World Beyond War is a global organization with hundreds of thousands of people in over 150 countries, but they're almost all volunteer. And to the extent that you or anybody you know has any little bits of time to volunteer, you know, we're looking for people to help in every aspect at every level, including joining our coordinating committee and running the whole show.
Okay, David. David Swanson, thank you very much. We'll have your information on World Beyond War up at our Wiki Politiki website and radio site. We'll be back after this message with Jewel Bistrova, who is going to talk about literally being in the trenches now. Thank you.
Free your mind with OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential, so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
I rescued Toast from a shelter in 2011. I love Toast because she's a lazy diva. Toast does whatever she wants, obviously. She's sleeping right now. She's so loving. She's so comforting. When I walked into the shelter, I knew right then that she was special.
Toast, Instagram star and shelter pet. Amazing adoption stories start in shelters. Start yours today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Steve Verman here, and welcome to the final segment of our Christmas in the Trenches show. We've heard from David Swanson, worldbeyondwar.org. I encourage you to go check that site out and find out ways that you can participate in restoring the sane asylum here in the world. This next segment, we have another guest, Jewel Bistrova. And Jewel is somebody who literally is in the trenches in the current battles. Jewel, I was particularly moved a year ago when I heard her speak about her experiences as an activist volunteer at Standing Rock. And since we all know that peace and justice go hand in hand, I wanted to speak with someone who's literally in the trenches to discuss the battles at hand and how to move beyond marching to standing together. Welcome, Jewel.
Hi there, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Good. Great to have you. So tell us a little bit about what prompted you to put everything else aside last year and go to be at Standing Rock.
Well, I could give you the whole back-end story of a number of events that were going on in my life in the last couple of years that put me in an interesting position of letting go of a lot of things and ready for something new. But honestly, that even though that may have set the stage, the real reason that I went to Standing Rock is also coincidentally or not synchronistically the same reason a lot of people I met there had the same exact experience, which is that we received what we call the call. So it was that it just was clear as day in a meditation that I had one day, and it was almost, for me, this is my personal experience, I literally heard, okay, you need to go to Standing Rock. And I was like, what? So I went, okay, I guess it took a while for me to prepare myself and get a lot of my life affairs in order so I could go after I received the call. But I received it fairly early on in the battle in the spring when we started hearing about it. But when I finally got there in the fall, I met a number of other people who also spoke about this call. So it was literally like a spiritual shout out to anybody that could hear that was being pulled there. And the spiritual leader of Standing Rock, Chief Arvo Looking Horse, spoke actually to this at some of the gatherings about the people that were being called to the front lines. And indeed, it was and continues to be a spiritual battle. And that's the trenches that I continue to be in and was in before that.
What was it like there? How long were you there, first of all? What was it like, and what did you learn there? What was your experience?
Well, I was there off and on over the winter. I did come home, and then I think that's when you saw me talk, because I needed to recuperate. A lot of us got pretty sick, and I went back after that. And I was there until after it closed, the raids. So what did I experience there is not an easy question to answer in a sound bite, but I will say...
Well, you can take a big bite if you like. We have some time.
Big bite. A few bites.
A few bites, yeah.
I'll say that, first of all, it was... Well, like I said, primarily a spiritually coordinated, oriented battle where it was a nonviolent resistance to something that was just horrendous, but also not new in the pipeline that was being laid to go across the river there, that is their source of their water So the focus was, this is our water, this is our life. Water is life, and you are threatening that, literally our lives, on the reservation there at Standing Rock. But it's not a new thing. I mean, there are many pipelines already, and the sense was that enough is enough. It's just like this we just can't keep, backing off of these things. We've just got to make a stand. And those that made the beginning was catalyzed actually by the youth, who just, saw their future before them that didn't look very, very good if this continues. And they have also, of course, the energy and the passion to deal with the elements of camping out and standing in frontline resistance action. So the youth were really a driving force, and then the elders came in to bring in a grounding, a spiritual grounding, and that it was really always intended and meant to be action of prayer and spiritual resistance to this. And what I saw, though, was that there was a lot that went on in the camps, and as I mentioned, it is the best and the worst of humanity. So when you have a spiritual action like that, that's so deep and so grounded and so amazing, it brings a lot of healing to people, as well as trying to do that which we're trying to do, which is resist the pipeline. But in the camps and in the action, the activity of the camp, there was a lot of healing going on between the people there. Cultures, different races, people from all over the world were there. Activists from all over the world were there, and people that were just ended up there somehow or another. And so we had this cauldron of just this mixing pot of people interacting and trying to work together and running up against all of our stuff, because here we are on this battleground. It's bringing up a lot of fear, it could anyway, for people. And when you have fear involved, then that catalyzes all of our own inner demons and paranoias and things like that. So you've got that acting out. Ego stuff, power stuff, all the usual human things that go on, but we don't have this military structure like, you would in a war, for instance, where, okay, you follow the orders of the general. We're trying to follow orders, but it's who's the one in charge? Which elder do you talk to? So there is a lot of confusion on that level. What we understood was that this is a prayer camp. This is this is native-led. We follow the leadership of the indigenous people that live there, and those things were super clear to me anyway, and to a lot of us. So but there was a lot of other confusion going on as it grew, and as there was a lot of infiltration from the other side. So this is not new, by the way. Pretty much every nonviolent or resistance action that's happened in our country, say Occupy, the movement that happened around Bernie Sanders, the nonviolent activity of the 60s, the civil rights movement, all of these were infiltrated by the powers that be, if you will, the corporate interests that see what we're doing as a threat, and it is a threat to them. So they do actually employ PSYOPs activity, and they had people that came into the camp deliberately to play on that fear that we already maybe we already had, or bring it in by spreading rumors of raids and things like this that just played on people's fears, or creating conflict between leaders. Things that they do, this is tried and true methods. It's nothing new, and it works.
it works really well. That's why they keep doing it to all these movements. So I actually saw it happen, and now it's been confirmed. This isn't just a conspiracy theory or, you know, suspicion. It's actually confirmed that of the infiltrators. There was a whistleblower that came out that worked for the company that was employed by the pipeline, by DAPL. And so we have those documents. Anyway, that to watch that go down and watch that play out was very educational for me, to say the least.
Well, this is probably why this is really much more of a spiritual calling, because in order to withstand that kind of pressure and to have the discernment to see what's true and what is being used to get you stirred up in the wrong direction, I mean, in a certain regard, it's building a certain kind of muscle.
Exactly, and that's why I believe that all of these battles, and now the front line is everywhere. It's not just in Standing Rock, it's everywhere that we are up against these things within ourselves. And I absolutely believe that we can't sustain that front line, what's happening at the front lines of today, unless we grow spiritually, unless we heal our own inner wounds, traumas that we maybe have been carrying around our whole life, or maybe just, you know, had a recent something happen, whatever it is, unless we are able to face our own fears and demons inside us, we can't have that ability to discern what's outside of us very well.
So what's your now that you're back from there, what's your calling in your work right now in this regard?
I actually haven't stopped, really. There is a local group, the No DAPL group, that's focusing on divestment, that I have been part of in a peripheral way.
Yeah, part of the what?
And,
you hear my dog barking, huh?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Dog barking.
My dog is barking. It's okay. That dog is totally safe, and he will not bite. Anyway, so go ahead. Especially if you're listening on the radio, the dog will not bite you, I promise.
Yeah. Well, since I left, I continued to work after a period of recovery. I continue to work with, I've been working with a movement called Transition. Which is all over the planet. It started in, you're familiar with it? And there's locally we have the national office in Sebastopol. So I'm involved with them, and we put on our first national conference, and I invited one of the matriarchs, one of the main women that of Standing Rock there to come speak. So I've been involved in stuff ever since, in just how do we begin to understand each other with the messages of indigenous people, and how incredibly important that is in this time and day of history that we're in. Vital that we listen to them, and yet that brings up a lot of you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding, tension, and conflict between the cultures and the races, because of so much historical trauma and oppression that has happened, and colonialism. So I've been very deep in that conversation, and also in how do we, which has also made me informed my work in how to help people in trauma, which I do in a private practice. I'm also a holistic health and healing practitioner, mm-hmm. and counselor. Minister as well, so I work with people on a daily basis. So I've been using what I do and what I know to inform what I'm doing on a kind of a bigger scale and collective scale, like how do we heal, how do we bring healing, how do we bring the spiritual growth. And I'm not talking about religious. There's no belief system necessarily attached to this, other than, you know, spiritual is for me like what is. How do we bring this consciousness of connectedness versus separation? And I honestly don't believe we're going to get beyond war or this divisiveness in general until we reach some threshold in our consciousness where we have realized that we're all connected and that we need to honor the earth, we need to honor each other, we need to honor ourselves, and that realizing the complete, absolute web of all of that, how it's all connected. We pull at one thread and another one is also affected. So that's the work, you know, the healing, the trauma healing, bringing education around the decolonizing and, you know, re-indigenizing our awareness of the of how to connect with the earth and listen to the people that have kept that in their culture for all these thousands of years is part of the healing for me.
It certainly sounds like, as so many people are coming to understand, that the what we call a political conversation or even an economic conversation is really a spiritual conversation. It's a personal psychological conversation. It has to do with our own relationship with the all that is. It has to do with our own faith and our connection to the web of life. And ultimately, in a certain regard, our collective psyche as a fractal of the individual psyche. And so this has to happen on many levels. We have about a minute left, so I want to ask you one final question, Joel. What is it that keeps you going and persisting, that encourages you, you know, in this darkness? Well, I guess we have to end now. I'm sorry that you won't get to answer that question. But thank you so much. You can say something?
I was going to say you can see more about what I'm doing at eraofcare.net.
I will list that on my website, and people will find you. Thank you, Joel Bistrova, and thank you, David Swanson. Thank you, Shanti Norman, for your beautiful rendition, Christmas in the Trenches. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki.